Well, man, I'm going to introduce a man who get down now for you. I mean, he's funky. He's going to move in next door to your lawn. We'll dive or so. Hey, here comes the colonel.
I'll never know where these characters come from. Well, welcome back to the second half of The Promise of Tomorrow here on the Science News Radio Network, exploring the business of emerging science, nanotechnology, open innovation. I'm your host. I'm Colonel Mason. And it begs the question, which would you rather have? Would you rather have global warming or global cooling? Well, at one time, scientists thought the Earth was going to get considerably colder. And that wasn't too long ago. Anyway, we're going to bring back Dr. Stephen Snyder, Stanford University, the late Dr. Snyder. We recorded him in 2009, about less than a year before he died. And he's going to tell us that there was a pretty scary time when we thought the Earth was going to get considerably cooler. And, of course, the other program, listener comments are the voice of reason. But right now, let's step over to our fountain of useless information we have here on the set. Rummage around with a coin jar a little bit for today's query.
Welcome to the Fountain of Youthless Information. How can I help you?
Yes, of course. We have awakened the spirit of the fountain by throwing in the coins. The spirit of the fountain who knows all, hears all, sees all, and tells all. For a price, all right. Okay, old spirit of the fountain, here's an easy one for you. Harney Peak, located in the Black Hills. It's an attraction in which state? In which state in the Black Hills is Harney Peak an attraction?
I have given you my answer. And now you may tell me.
The spirit of the fountain knows. Harney Peak, located in the Black Hills, in which state? If you said North Dakota, you're absolutely wrong. No, it's in South Dakota. All right, I thought everybody knew that. Okay, all right, on with our program. Okay, for those of us who like things pretty much as they are, we have a hard time answering the questions of which we'd rather have, global warming or global cooling. Well, it seems in 1970, scientists thought the Earth was going to get considerably colder. Here's an encore interview we did with the late Stephen Snyder, professor at Stanford University, climatologist, noted climatologist, as a matter of fact. This was done in 2009, just a few months before he died.
I began my career in 1970. And we didn't know warming from cooling in 1970. In fact, as a grad student, I worked for a guy at NASA, and we put dust from human pollution, you know, burning coal, oil, and gas with sulfur. Mm-hmm. Gas doesn't have sulfur, but the others do. And that makes hazes, the industrial smogs, and they make the world brighter, therefore they cool the planet. Well, we didn't know whether that won over carbon dioxide, the greenhouse gas that heats the planet. So we did a calculation, and we assumed that the dust and smoke were everywhere in the world, and that carbon dioxide was the only greenhouse gas, and we concluded it was going to get cooler. And, of course, lots of colleagues yelled and screamed, and they were right. But nobody really knew. So what happened in the next 3 years, from 1970 to 73, is that the community got together and figured out that the problem with that calculation was that the assumption that the human pollution, the hazes, was all around the globe was wrong, that it was largely concentrated in the industrial areas and where we burn biomass. So maybe a fifth of the world was covered with these hazes. But the CO2, the greenhouse gas, within 1 year, it spreads globally. So we overestimated the cooling by about a factor of four by assuming that the dust was global. Then, by 1974, we discovered that methane and nitrous oxide and chlorofluorocarbons were also greenhouse gases. So we found out there were more greenhouse gases. They were all global, and the dust was much more regional. And by 1974, the community was pretty well convinced that human effects would be warming more than cooling. So that's been sort of the evolution of this. I just finished writing a book that'll be out for the National Geographic Society this fall called Science as a Contact Sport, because mm-hmm. my life has been so combative arguing with people about these things. I try to, you know, have fun with everything, even unpleasant subjects like this. And I give the long history of this, including why I was wrong, and that, in fact, I am super proud of it, because in science, you don't mind getting the the wrong answer as long as it's for the right reasons. That is, the answer we gave you fit the assumptions. But then what scientists do is they keep re-questioning their assumptions, and as we re-questioned the assumptions, it became clear that the answer was wrong. And I was glad that I was the first guy to publish what was wrong with my earlier study, not the critics, me. So, you know, we're very happy when that happens. You know, if we make an initial diagnosis, like any good doc who then runs the tests, and then the tests say, no, you were wrong, you don't stay with the original diagnosis, that is, you know, politically consistent. However, it's been consistently warm in the predictions since about 1974 and 75. And nobody is arguing that nature is not a piece of this. But what we're arguing is that nature's dominant role started to disappear around 1960, 1970. In the last 40 years or so, human activities have really taken over as the massive number of people in the world and our improved standard of living and our using cheap and dirty energy to get there is driving the system.
Okay, so the Earth is warming, and man is the cause. Those are the conclusions.
Warming, Colonel. The recent warming.
The recent warming. Okay.
I would never claim anything back before about 1970. That was probably a mix of both.
Okay, so you wouldn't go back to the beginning of the Industrial Revolution of the 1880s.
Well, I think we had a hand in that. But it's impossible based on data to separate out the relative components of humans and nature, because there were three causes of climate change. One is just natural variability. That is, nothing is changing in terms of forcing the system. It just, the energy exchanges between the big reservoirs, the atmosphere and the oceans and the glaciers, you know, and the trees, the ecosystems, that can cause fluctuations on the order of a few tenths of a degree warming from decade to decade, and has been doing that for time immemorial. You know, and there are natural processes which make much larger changes, like ice ages and interglacial cycles, and that has to do with changes in the orbital elements of the Earth around the Sun that are due to the tug of gravity from Jupiter and Saturn on our planet, which makes, you know, how the tropics of Cancer and Capricorn are at 23 and what is it, a quarter? Well, that's not true. 9,000 years ago, it was 24 and a quarter. The map had to be redrawn. Hmm. That meant a whole different pattern of sun. So the very long term, the thousands, you know, to hundreds of thousands of years, those were all naturally driven, and those were driven by energy changes in the sun, and then there were so-called feedbacks, which changed carbon dioxide and methane. But in the recent times, when the sun is, the orbit is stable, by recent, I mean, in the last millennium or two, nature was dominant in terms of changing the sun a little and volcanic eruptions, that kind of thing, causing a few tenths of a degree change over time, and that has been going on and will continue to go on. We don't make El Niños and we don't make hurricanes, but we can change the intensity by warming the oceans from the greenhouse gases. So it's going to be a combination of both us and nature, but as our footprint gets bigger and bigger, we become increasingly powerful, and that's basically the story that you'll get from the scientific community.
Well, I'm going to ask you something that was printed in the Science Daily back a few weeks ago. They said attempting to tackle climate change by trapping carbon dioxide or switching to nuclear power will not solve the problem of global warming. And they credited something published in the July issue of International Journal of Global Warming by Bo Nordell and Bruno Gervet at the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Luleå University of Technology in Sweden. They calculated the total energy emissions from the start of the Industrial Revolution in the 1880s to the modern day. And they're saying that there's nothing that we can do to stop it if by simply removing CO2. Now, how do you feel about that study?
Well, I haven't seen that study yet. What happens when we get together about every 5 years in the IPCC or the National Academy of Sciences is we take a look at the literature written in the last 5 years. You get 100 people in the room, you fight it out, you write a preliminary report, you get it reviewed by hundreds of people on the outside, and then you try to make a fair judgment. So I'm you know, behind. Anyhow, that's not a standard journal. I don't know what that is. But the argument that the total amount of heat released, is that what you suggest?
Yeah.
That's trivial. That they made a mistake. That's all I could say. Because we know that the total amount of heat released by all the human activities that mobilize energy is something on the order of 1 part in 10,000 of all the energy that comes in from the sun. So while locally New York City could be 10 degrees warmer in the middle of January at night than Scarsdale, the suburb, due to what we call the urban heat island, at a planetary scale, the total amount of heat release, this has been known for a long time, is very, very small. It's locally important, but globally it isn't. Now, it's in there, but it's a very small number, whereas if you calculate the total amount of heat that's trapped from carbon dioxide, methane, and so forth, it's about 2 watts of energy over every square meter, which is something on the order of, you know, a percent of the sunlight, not a 10,000th. So I have no idea how they made the argument that this is due to thermal inertia, thermal pollution, excuse me. It's just simply demonstrably wrong. It's been shown over and over and over again by people who've summarized it, if that's what they said.
Well, Steve, they also say that there's a flaw in the nuclear energy argument, that although nuclear energy doesn't produce carbon dioxide emissions the same way as burning fossil fuels, it does produce heat emissions equivalent to 3 times the energy of the electricity it generates. But you would discount that too, wouldn't you?
I would say that that is locally significant. I first wrote a paper on this back in 1974, mm-hmm. and we looked up what was the most amount of energy anybody could consider. It was Herman Kahn. Some people may remember him from he wrote a book called Thinking the Unthinkable about nuclear war. And in any case, he had a vision which they called his 2020 vision: 20 billion people on Earth using 20 kilowatts per capita. So now we have 6 billion, and they're using 5 kilowatts per capita. I can't remember the exact number. So it was dramatic. And when we calculated that out with the heat released from the fact that the nuclear energy, just like coal, they're both the same. You know, they're only about a third efficient. Two-thirds of the heat is dumped in the cooling towers or into the waters.
Mm-hmm.
It was enough that it would raise the Earth's temperature a degree or so. That is a lot, but we're talking now about using 5 times more energy than anybody is projecting to be able to be 1 degree, whereas already the carbon dioxide and other gases that we've released, the Earth is almost that warm just from what we've done so far, and it's projected to be 3 to 5 times more in the next century if we keep on this track. So, of course, heat matters locally, and if you have an amazing amount of people, and, you know, we had 4 times the energy used per capita, then you could actually dump enough heat to be noticeable, you know, at the level of a degree warming. But these calculations have been done for 30 years, and I don't know how they came to this conclusion that is so different than all the other conclusions. Probably why I haven't heard of it, because it didn't make a splash among those people who know something about the problem. Sure, I'll run into the paper when we do the next assessment.
Okay, now what about the people that say that the CO2 couldn't possibly be the whole story is that it's water, not gas. The water just overwhelms everything else. I mean, how do you feel about that?
Well, having done a calculation where I actually had to put in the radiative transfer, as we call it, that's the amount of radiant energy that goes back and forth in all various wavelengths, from all the greenhouse gases and from the sun, I certainly agree that water vapor is the prime greenhouse gas on the Earth, not because it absorbs very much energy per molecule. It's actually very weak in how much it absorbs per molecule. It's just there are so many molecules out there relative to carbon dioxide or methane or one of those other gases, that it's the dominant greenhouse gas. In fact, we owe a lot to water vapor. The current world is something like 60 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than it would have been if it weren't for water vapor and carbon dioxide. And water vapor is most of that. So our very happy climate, you know, which supports our lives and the species that we know and love and all that, and we're not living in a perpetual ice age, is because the natural greenhouse effect has been our friend. You know, it's been responsible for our being here. However, we are adding other gases like carbon dioxide, methane, chlorofluorocarbons, and so forth. And what these gases do is they have much, much more absorption per molecule than CO2. We are not adding enough water vapor to make a material difference. Despite all the irrigation and all the land use changes, the vast bulk of the water vapor in the atmosphere is there because of the evaporation from the oceans, which are the majority of the Earth's surface, and from the evaporation from land, which we can influence, but not enough to make a major difference. So how is it that water vapor is still an important part of the prediction for the greenhouse warming? It's because the amount of water vapor in the air depends upon the amount that evaporates. And the amount that evaporates, everybody who's ever, you know, tried to water their lawn knows this. A hot day is going to suck more moisture out of the lawn than a cool day, and you'll have to water more. So as the earth warms up, for whatever reason, it's going to evaporate more water. Well, you know, what goes up must come down. It goes up in the atmosphere, and it comes down as more rain. But while it's in the atmosphere, there's more total amount of water vapor in the atmosphere in a warm world than a cold world. In fact, we have a name for this. We call this water vapor temperature feedback. So as the world warms up, there's more water vapor, which then amplifies the warming, maybe doubles it. And when you add CO2 and methane, even though water vapor as an average is a bigger heater than they are, water vapor isn't changing until your added CO2 and methane traps a few watts of energy over every square meter. That heats the earth up a degree or so, and then the earth evaporates more water, and that doubles the effect. So water vapor is still very important, but it goes through this long, complicated chain. Unfortunately, this is not a problem that's easily treated in a soundbite, you know, when you get 5 seconds on the evening news. Mm-hmm. And what I'm reporting to you is very common, been known for 50 years, and it's called the water vapor greenhouse feedback. So water vapor, yes, you're absolutely right, dramatically important, but we cannot directly influence it. We indirectly influence it by changing the heating of the earth through other gases, and then the warming causes more evaporation, so that serves as an amplifier.
Well, is trapping CO2 then the obvious answer to our controlling the rate of this global warming?
Well, CO2 is about half the story now, because the other greenhouse gases collectively, the other six of them that matter, are the other half. But if we're really going to have 9 billion people, we're really going to start getting per capita equality in energy use between India, China, and the richer countries, and they're going to use coal to get there, yes, and CO2 becomes the dominant factor by the middle to the late 21st century. It's the single largest greenhouse gas, but as I said, it's equal or slightly larger than the sum of the other five or six, you know, the methane and the chlorofluorocarbons and nitrous oxide, which comes out from ammonia fertilizer. And then there are some industrial chemicals like SF6 and the hydrochlorofluorocarbons and so forth. All of those together are worth about 2 to 3 watts. That's a couple of Christmas tree bulbs per square meter of heating on around the whole world. But there are also hazes and dusts which reflect sunlight, the thing that we talked about for ice ages a long time ago, and that offsets a good fraction, maybe a quarter to a half, of the greenhouse warming. Some people have said, well, why don't we just have dust and smoke as our, you know, counteractor, and we'll be even. The trouble is you don't want to solve global warming with acid rain and with air pollution that sends kids to the hospital with asthma. Every rich country has, you know, put controls on air pollution because of health, and China and India are starting to do the same thing. So what's going to happen is, because of health reasons, as we and they get richer, we start taking the dust and smoke out of the air because the air is healthier, and then all of a sudden you lose the offset and you actually get more warming. It's one of the ironies of the fact that two kinds of pollutant have been fighting each other, and as we take one out for health reasons, the other one starts to become even more dominant.
Oh, this is incredible. I mean, I'm not even thinking of these things.
Yeah, no, this is all part of the standard stuff in the, you know, in the history and the literature. And one of the reasons why it gets a little frustrating to some of us in the science world when we start listening to pundits, you know, paper publishing famous climate scientist Professor Limbaugh, mm-hmm. you know, or somebody like that, and they're just out there spouting all this stuff, and they don't know what they're talking about. And there's this community that's, you know, that spends all of its time earning dramatically less money doing due diligence on the details of this, and then they're writing reports, but these reports are complicated and they're not expressed in clean English. You know, we scientists are really lousy at communication, and therefore the public is confused by this banter out there. But if they spent any time at all on the web reading credible websites like Department of Energy or things like that, they can find out that most of the arguments that are out in the political realm are nonsense.
Okay, is cap and trade then, is that the answer, or do you subscribe to that solution?
Well, I have now you're asking for my personal value judgment about mm-hmm. how should we fix a risk, and I'm, of course, happy to give you my judgment. I just wanted to remind everybody, now I'm not talking like a scientist, now I'm just giving you an opinion.
Sure.
And my opinion is that you cannot make a market work if the price doesn't reflect all the costs. So the actual price of coal, for example, is not just extraction and transport, you know, and profit, but it also includes the damage to the lungs of children from the air pollution, the fact that the mercury means you can't eat more than one fish a month in Minnesota. I mean, things like that are part of the cost. So they've got to be inside the price. Otherwise, how can a free market work if people have the wrong incentives? So that's exactly, and this is not some radical view of a scientist. This is the economists that made this argument. They call it
the late, great Stephen Snyder, recorded in the summer of 2009, about a year before he died of a heart attack, and we sure miss him. And at this time, I want to thank you very much for those of you who have contributed to the this program. We depend on contributions from listeners like you for the existence of this show. We're totally science community supported. So those of you who have contributed, thank you very much. Those of you who wish to can do so at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. On the right-hand side of your screen, you'll see a little tab there for donations. Just click the donations, and we appreciate all your help.
And now, we make time for the voice of reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
Networking is more important now than it has ever been in my lifetime. It is huge, and it's not just networking live, it's also networking online using social media, etc. But you have to be everywhere. Just like employers, in theory, have to be everywhere, but they're not everywhere. They're just like telling people about their jobs, and you have to be everywhere so you can meet the people that know about these jobs. My name is Abby Kohut. I am the president of AbsolutelyAbby.com, and I am also an author, speaker, and consultant.
So you decide, has this really been the voice of reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
I am waiting for you.